This is the AdNonTech Podcast, conversations about education, technology, and culture, with Dr. Doug Reed and Dr. Matt Stranick. Thank you for joining us. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the latest in our series of AdNonTech conversations. The inestimable Dr. Doug Reed was regretfully unable to join us in the middle of this working day. He did send his sincere regards because, quite frankly, he was stoked, as I, sir, am legitimately stoked to have Mr. Stephen Downs with us. Stephen is, among many, many other things, one of the, I would say, significant presences, to use a term, within our e-learning field. Certainly, since I became involved in the graduate level area with this stuff, I mean, your work, Stephen, along with your colleagues, connectivism at the time was the term that was being used, circa about 10 or 12 years ago when I was kind of looking at your work. It is the greatest pleasure. We are sincerely honored to have Stephen Downs with us to hopefully give us some insights into what he does and what he's about. Stephen, thank you so much for being here.
Well, thanks for the kind welcome. I think maybe you built me up a bit too much, but
no.
Certainly my pleasure to be here.
Awesome. And again, sir, I'm not sure how much, again, for people listening or watching the video, I suppose, this is something where I've been spending a bit more time than what I've been sort of accustomed to due to a realignment within my career as late. And so as part of the idea of expanding the show, this and the music podcast, too, as a matter of fact, we're trying to get more interviews. We're trying to draw people in whose perspectives are necessarily different in various ways than what the inestimable Dr. Doug Reed and myself would necessarily bring. And as I said in the, I don't think it was a hyperbolic intro at all, quite frankly, because the impact of Stephen, I mean, if you've ever gone to any of the major e-learning conferences, which there are many, actually, well outside of Canada, well outside of North America, I mean, I guess my opening gambit, though, typically for these interviews, sir, is really because we're trying to reach as many people as we can outside even the education field. For those who somehow have missed your work in the e-learning area, the distance learning area, what is who is Stephen, if I may, and what are you about, sir?
Oh, my. First of all, I'm not about being sir.
Okay, fair enough. Just maritimer politeness. You know the drill.
I get you. So I just want to position myself correctly, right? So, as I said at a recent group meeting recently, I'm a guy who codes, which isn't completely true, of course, but the standard line I give people, I'm sorry to give you a standard line, but hey, you opened with the standard question, so that's what you get, is that my work is at the intersection of four disciplines. Computing, obviously, education, not surprisingly, philosophy, and journalism. My formal education is in philosophy. And that's where a lot of my ideas come from. journalism helps me communicate and get those ideas across as clearly as possible. Education is a discipline that I fell into, partly because I spent a lot of time teaching at college and university level, and partly because my areas of philosophy are in the, my interests in philosophy are in the areas of processes of learning, inference, and discovery. You know, in other words, how we think, how we learn, how we do things. And this is the sort of thing that, that gets me interested. And then computing is the tool that I use. The objective of my work, and this came from all of these different directions, is to create mechanisms that help people pursue their own interests to the greatest degree possible. You know, it's unhindered by social economic factors, unhindered by their background, their language, their religion, where they were born, who they are. You know, there are far too many barriers in our world today preventing people from being the most that they can be. And the route that I've chosen to help with this, and there are many routes, and I've just chosen one, is through education, or more accurately, access to learning, and even more accurately than that, an understanding of learning that helps people learn for themselves rather than it being something that we provide for people. And if people can learn for themselves using the tools of technology, then they can become what they aspire to be and live happy and fulfilled lives. And that's what I'm all about.
Wow. Wow, sir, that is deeply impressive. For those who are just kind of, again, perhaps maybe not as aware of Stephen and his colleagues and their work as one should be, quite frankly, is that Stephen travels the world on a pretty regular basis, not exclusively on behalf of his role as a researcher with the Government of Canada on distance-based learning and initiatives of the sort. Sir, I guess what I would begin with is, again, I really appreciate your connection to philosophy and journalism, because I am my thing originally is as an English teacher. And I've just been passionate about narrative and everything that goes with narrative since I was a small kid. And I just, you know, and then in terms of the philosophy, it always just struck me as, well, this is just kind of the other side of it. One sort of about language, one sort of about, you know, how you get to that point that you can even express something. So when I see, you know, you talking about these kind of contemporary evidence-based, you know, approaches, in terms of, you know, what you explore in your research, it always just really lands with me, because, you know, it seems like the philosophical dimension is just kind of, people kind of don't deal with it directly in peer review literature, even a bit. It's like they sort of pack it into their study design, and then they just kind of, you know, don't do much with it. You, clearly, through your numerous outputs, you know, research, writing, blogging, you know, the extremely prolific profile you've had, philosophy is always at the center of it, and that is what has resonated with me, as I said. So I guess in terms of how you ended up doing what you're doing, can you describe a little bit what aspect of the government you work for? What you typically do within that role, and then what made you passionate or interested to follow this path that led you to where you currently are?
Okay. No one is more surprised than me to find that I work for the government, except perhaps the government itself. You know, I started with National Research Council here in Canada 2001, and basically NRC was setting up a collection of what they called e-business research areas in Atlantic Canada, and one of those was e-learning. And so I was recruited to join that initiative, and which was came at a good time for me. I had worked at the University of Alberta for a couple of years as an information architect, and that work was just winding down. And if you're curious, what I did there is I built an online community called MuniMall for municipal government officials in Alberta, elected officials and appointed officials.
Cool.
And it served as the basis for the municipal studies program out of the Faculty of Extension for the next 10 years. So I was pretty pleased with that.
Definitely.
So anyhow, yeah, I went to NRC as a specialist in e-learning. Prior to my work at NRC, in addition to MuniMall, I had focused on e-learning technology with the Assiniboine Community College. I built their website. I built their general business certificate program. I built a number of online things. I built a learning management system for them. I just wasn't as well connected as Murray Goldberg, so I didn't get to sell it. No, I'm kidding. It was never.
That was a joke, if you're listening.
Yeah. It was never as professional a product as he created. He was a proper computer scientist. I was a designer who dabbled.
I'm sorry, designer who dabbled. Sir, I don't mean to kind of horn in on what you're describing here, but it just seems that as you're kind of describing your own journey, there's just some things that are kind of landing, in as much as this field that we're in seems to draw people from so many different backgrounds and many different skills that, you know, I've remarked on this before. It's come up on the show where there's very few learning technologists and or, you know, ICT specialists coming right out of your undergrad. And then you do, you know, it's just kind of like, well, I'm working on something and I have certain technical abilities. And quite frankly, that's what makes it interesting for me to be in this area. I wonder if you find it kind of similar within your role, just, you know, the fact that it's a different thing every day, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, I described some of the prehistory. I wouldn't be doing anything like that these days. You know, these days I'm looking at blockchain and artificial intelligence and metaverse and related subjects, still dabbling, of course. What the one constant throughout, and this is the story not just of me, but of the entire internet, is that there are no college or university programs for doing what we did. You know, the internet was not built by people who studied how to build an internet. They and I had to learn for ourselves as we went along. And this is the main piece of evidence that convinces me, you know, just how, you know, how powerful, you know, personal learning can be. Learning, pursuing one's own interests and following one's own path. You know, you can do things like build an internet. You can do things like create blockchain from scratch. You can write artificial intelligence. Now, today, for all of these things, right, there are university programs for instructional design. There's university programs for that, right? So, you know, and that's fine. And people follow and they do that for a living. And that's exactly the point, right? These technologies and approaches are developed. They're developed because not just because they're cool, but because they serve a useful function. And we know the sorts of functions that I've tried to fulfill. And then people follow along and they use these technologies. They learn these technologies and they do cool things. And, yes. You know, I love it that, you know, instructional technology or learning design, etc., that these are disciplines and that people are practicing these, because every designer out there is helping someone learn, probably in a way or at a time that they wouldn't have been able to learn in the past. So I think that's a great thing.
Absolutely. And again, you really have some very thoughtful, you know, sort of higher level comments about, you know, the field, which is precisely why I kind of reached out to people through LinkedIn, which sort of, I don't know, it seemed to be that Elon Musk Twitter used to be somewhat viable, you know, because a lot of our colleagues, you know, in various areas obviously spent a lot of time sort of building up presences, to use a term, on Twitter. And then with the arrival of X, it's sort of deplatformed itself almost.
Yeah.
It's been interesting to me to sort of see where people are going for those kind of connections. I wonder, sir, because again, sort of, I would love to take a deep dive on learning theory and all of these things with you, but I guess to be respectful of the more general audience who might be just kind of checking it out, like, what does a learning scientist do for a living kind of deal? You know, my thing here is simply, are you working on now that you are most passionate about? And what are you working on now that is most problematic, if those two are not the same thing?
I don't know if they're the same thing or not. I mean, the main thing I do these days is my newsletter. I have a daily newsletter called OL Daily.
And it's awesome, by the way, actually. Thanks. It's used. Yeah, definitely. You should check it out. Anybody who's watching or listening to this definitely needs to check out OL Daily.
One day I'll write papers about it, but I've never written a paper about it. But
I'm surprised you haven't, actually, because you've been doing that on the regular for a while. And what I've noticed again, sir, as you were kind of making, sir, I'm sorry to use the S word, but, you know, when you were speaking earlier about, you know, the philosophical dimensions of, of learning, that's sort of like where my ears prick up. That's where I go, okay, that's me. But then you start talking about, you know, you're somebody who, to me, it's very rare in our field. You have people who are conversant with how computing technology actually works, you know, at a granular technical practical level. So when I see the OL Daily, when I see, you know, your other websites and blogs and work, you know, it's like you're hyping the RSS feed on the newsletter. Like that's, I'm not saying that's old school. I am saying that's maybe a bit different than, you know, people who just kind of devolve those technical aspects onto the platform. You know, like I'm doing everything on the WordPress site because to me, that's just the most effective way. I wonder about the newsletter and how long you've been doing it and what, you know, people can expect from that and what's with RSS anyway, sir.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised to see you migrating to Ghost at some time in the future. WordPress seems to be imploding a bit.
That's a shame.
Yeah, it is. But, you know, it's what happens with technology a lot of the times. It's just become over-engineered, trying to be too many things to too many people.
Totally.
Not to slag WordPress at all. I mean, I've spent a lot of time with it.
It has happened to every platform at some point. It's not almost like a trophy of sorts.
But. Yeah. So, you know, RSS really is old school. RSS, my newsletter was an RSS newsletter before it was an email newsletter. It was started out as RSS in 1998, and I added the email version in 2001. It's sort of funny, because most people do it the other way around. They start with the email newsletter. But that wasn't really practical in 98. And besides that, you know, RSS was new and exciting and seemed like something. And I still think it seems like something, although today, you know, we're sort of doing the same thing in a different way. With what's called the Fediverse. And I noticed you mentioned LinkedIn and how a lot of people have jumped into LinkedIn. And I'm in LinkedIn just because it's not my favorite platform. And I keep forgetting that people send me messages on it.
You responded like, to mine, so I'm cool. But thank you.
Yeah, I know, but that was only after searching my email for your message for 10 minutes and just not finding it, which is silliness. But I was also on Twitter. I was never really a Twitter ratty. I followed exactly one account, and that was Twitter's own account.
Wow. Although
I did gather followers, but I always viewed Twitter more as a publishing platform, and that's what Elon Musk took over, was a publishing platform, and now he's publishing his own particular ideology, which most people find offensive. For that and similar reasons, I no longer participate on Facebook, no longer participate on Twitter. My main network now is something called Mastodon, spelled like the ancient big elephant type thing. Have an account on mastodon.social. It's just Downs as usual.
Because we're getting now into, again, thinking to the general audience now, because they actually probably have, this is the part of it that kind of, I think, lands for people outside of the e-learning. And I'm really actually legitimately curious because, right, everything you've said about, I remember when Twitter was like billed as micro-blogging, right?
Yeah.
That was the appeal. And I actually, as like somebody who writes stories, I even did some Twitter poetry, right? Like haiku, Twitter coup. And just kind of pinging at the format a bit. And it did seem, kind of viable at the time. It's now turned into, I'm glad you kind of put it out there first, it's a propaganda machine by a right-wing, lunatic who has been given far too much power by far too many oligarchs, that's my opinion. Mm-hmm. But now in the wake of that, Mastodon, the inestimable Dr. Doug Reed is actually quite a fan of Mastodon. He kind of let me know about it as something that was cool. I checked into Blue Sky Social, which is like, Dorsey, whatever, the Twitter or guy.
Yeah, Jack Dorsey, yeah.
Right. And then, it was sort of like seeded as a startup. And then I thought, okay, there's some legitimate, of my peers kind of going into this. But then I just kind of sat there looking at it after a couple of weeks. And I'm just like, I it does not bring me joy, to use the term like Marie Kondo or whatever. It's like, it doesn't bring me joy. So I just kind of been ignoring it. So Mastodon is your regular go-to. Do you actually follow people on Mastodon, sir?
I actually do follow people on Mastodon.
Okay.
So I started on Mastodon in 2016 when it was young and fresh, and we had this little cluster of people who got to know each other over the years. Now it's big and posh, and there's a ton of people on it, and it's not quite the same, but I still follow that original group plus a bunch more. Awesome. I try not to overload myself, but I'm pretty chatty on Mastodon, and I don't take it that seriously, nor should you. But what's important here is that Mastodon and also Blue Sky and also Threads, which is a product of Facebook, and also Diaspora and some other smaller projects, these are all parts of what is called the Fediverse. And they don't all use exactly the same standards, although many of them use one called ActivityPub. But the main point is that it takes social networking and it eliminates the silo. And what I mean by that is, if you're on Twitter, you can't send a message to Facebook. If you're on Facebook, you can't send a message to Twitter. And even worse, if you're on Twitter, you can't just move you and all your followers to Facebook. It's just not possible. But with the Fediverse, you have that ability to send a message to anybody else in the system. And you can move yourself and your followers from one instance, that's what they're called, from one instance to another to another. I'm on Mastodon Social, but I could move to social.coop, for example. And I can follow people who are on Blue Sky.
Okay.
I can follow people, kind of in theory still, but on people who are on Threads. And a lot of applications, like authoring applications, are also joining the Fediverse, which makes life pretty interesting. Ghost, correct, which is the alternative to WordPress that I mentioned, okay, is moving to the Fediverse. There is a plugin for WordPress that turns your WordPress instance into a member of the Fediverse. And I actually have a WordPress blog that nobody's heard of called leftish.media.
Okay, so thank you, Stephen. First of all, folks, nobody had heard of it. I'm leveraging whatever ridiculous thing I can on this platform to just kind of raise the profile of things that I find interesting. And again, just everything you're saying sounds rad, highly rad. Fediverse is in federated, as in because it sounds almost, and it sounds almost blockchain-ish. There's a similar principle there in terms of, it's not just import or export your contacts, is it? It's integration of platforms at a pretty fundamental level, which is a very unique feature, which I appreciate your speaking to here, because it sounds fascinating.
Think of ActivityPub as kind of like distributed messaging.
Okay.
It's more about messaging than anything else.
Cool.
And then you can just move your messaging information from one place to another. Blockchain is more about distributed databases. And to be more accurate, distributed write-only databases. And
awesome.
That's what all the cryptography does, is it makes blockchain write only. You can't go back and change entries once they've been written. That's the key technological feature of blockchain.
Thank you for that very lucid overview, because I've been literally from my kind of, I'm in the technology area, but I don't have a technology perspective on it, which is why things kind of went pear-shaped for me at Thompson Rivers. But anyway, so thank you for that very lucid overview. You probably get asked that kind of thing fairly often, don't you? What's this ubiquitous overused term actually in terms of its function and purpose, such as you just did? So I just wanted to say thank you for that, sir.
Oh, well, no problem. It's interesting, because it's funny. I want to go back to where you said where the joy is. Because it's never the technology that brings you joy. And that's where that whole slogan is kind of misleading. If I had to put it in a different slogan form, it's your network or your connections or your colleagues or your friends that bring you joy. And the technology is a mechanism for connecting them. To the extent that it succeeds, it brings you joy. To the extent that it fails, it does not bring you joy. And that's what's been happening with Twitter and with Facebook. They have been failing to connect you with your friends, and instead have been connecting you with political messaging and advertisement. And they need to do that in order to make money, right?
Sure.
Mastodon is a non-commercial initiative. It doesn't need to insert advertising into its feeds. It doesn't need an algorithm to tell you what's important, right? You can decide for yourself what's important. And if you want an algorithm, because it's open source, you can write an algorithm for yourself, or over time, there aren't really any useful ones yet, but over time, you can find a useful algorithm that will organize and sort your Mastodon feed. That's coming. That's not here yet. And that's a really big difference, right? And it's actually, just in terms of human communication, it's paradigm shifting in the sense that it really does represent a transition from broadcasting to peer-to-peer communication.
Okay.
Commercial social media is broadcasting.
Yes.
That's why people like it, right? They don't want to leave Twitter because they think they can post a tweet on Twitter and it'll be broadcast to the whole world, whereas on Mastodon, it'll only be broadcast to their friends. And who wants to talk to people who already like you? But they're misled. I mean, it's to me, it's misleading. You post a tweet on Twitter, it's just as likely to die and be obscure as it is to be broadcast to any significant number of people. On Facebook, it's even less likely. I mean, I left Facebook, I guess it's 6 years ago now. And the reason why I left Facebook was that I had like 1,000 some odd followers, I forget the exact number, and I'd post something on Facebook and it would be seen by 24 of my followers. And I'm thinking, what's the meaning of a follower on Facebook if most of the people who quote unquote follow me aren't seeing the things that I post? That makes no sense to me. All they're seeing are the advertisements and whatever the algorithm wants to promote. And it's kind of like a lottery, and everybody buys the lottery thinking, yeah, I'm going to win the Facebook lottery. My post will be promoted to thousands of people. But it rarely happens, and it only happens to famous people.
There's so many rabbit holes or vectors that I could go down with this. Everything that you're describing absolutely speaks to the utter commercialization and the utter muddying of the contemporary media ecosystem, if you will. I mean, it's just a lot of shallow water and stagnant ponds and kind of fish that are just kind of looking like they'd rather be anywhere else. If we can sort of extrapolate from what you've kind of described there, a fellow maritimer, I hope you'll forgive me the
fish analogy. Yeah,
exactly. So. Or even just over-reliance on metaphors to kind of, repack what you just described for myself and potentially others. Because there are a few things I do want to be mindful of, keeping this to, roughly 40 minutes. And there are just a couple of key kind of things I just want to make sure that I ask you, semi-scripted bulleted list here. So first of all, I became aware of you, and rightly or wrongly, I think a lot of people who have heard of you, outside of, your kind of medium or kind of immediate kind of circumstances through something called connectivist learning theory. And for sure, I know you kind of got many other significant works and contributions, but again, as something that kind of got a lot of public recognition or play, so to speak, particularly when the so-called open courses kind of, which you were clearly, associated with, along with certain other colleagues, some of whom have already been on the show.
I'm your like second or third choice then.
You're the person who gave me the availability of this week as opposed to the week previous. It's literally, for people who I'm just, I just look at it like dialing for dollars. I'm just like, you're a highly noted person in the area. So again, much respect to like, going this far with a weak tie, in your social thing or a non-existent one, as the case may be. But I do have to really kind of just ask on behalf of a hypothetical listener, what's the deal with connectivism? Is it still a thing? So to be plain about it, if I can ask.
I mean, it's not a political movement, so it doesn't really matter whether it's a thing or not.
Okay. It's a political movement.
No, it's not a political
it's
movement.
It's not. Good. Phew. Because I was prepared to follow you, but I'm glad that it's
not. No, it's totally not. It has nothing to, it doesn't matter whether it's a thing. It doesn't matter whether people believe in it or not. And to that extent, I don't care.
So, again, if you could sort of, for somebody who, again, just is hearing the term for the first time, and given that you're as closely associated with it in your research and, public outputs as you have been and perhaps are, So what is it about generally? And I mean, yeah. Is it still something that you spend a lot of time with, mental bandwidth, dealing with, or thinking about, or writing about?
I did come out with a paper on it a year, 2 years, 3 years ago. But okay, here's the dollar version. Okay, connectivism is the thesis that knowledge is the organization of connections across distributed entities, where a connection is a linkage such that a change in one entity can result in a change in another entity. So it's not just that they're associated, there's an actual causal connection there. And therefore, learning is the development and organization of these connections. That's all it is.
Now, okay.
Now, that's network theory. It's based in network theory. There's a whole mathematics of network theory, which I won't get into. But again, doesn't matter if people believe in it. It's mathematics, right? You know,
the weather doesn't care if you appreciate it. Gravity, similarly, right?
So. Yeah. So, now where things get more interesting is when we consider human thought, because humans have knowledge, and so we're asking, well, what is knowledge for a human? Well, for a human, knowledge is the organization of connections across a set of entities, like I've said. In this case, the entities are neurons, and depending on whether you're into embodiment theory or not, it may involve other physical aspects of human physiology. But from my perspective, for the sake of discussion, mostly neurons, which means that learning is all about developing, growing, and shaping neural connections. And there are lots of ways we can talk about that. We can talk about, you know, if we think of learning that way, then what does pedagogy look like that way? And it looks like is a lot of practice, because you have to train neurons.
Because that's kind of, you know, I've spent, like a lot of people maybe listening to this have, a lot of my career post-secondary, fair bit of it in the so-called faculty development space, right? Teaching centers and the like. I think all of which are rad. To use a term, but, you know, what you're describing, I think, kind of goes even a bit beyond what somebody might experience, right? Like, you know, they go to this teaching center for the strategy. What you're talking about is sort of having your ducks in a row in terms of your thinking, and then, you know, having achieved some modicum of clarity in that regard, then sort of determining your pedagogy situationally and contextually. Is that something that a fair?
Yeah. So once you realize that, okay, you're trying to teach somebody, what you're really trying to do is get them to grow their neural connections in the appropriate way.
Yes.
And there's a whole side discussion about what the appropriate way is, but we'll leave that aside. So what does that mean for you as a teacher? Well, how do you grow neural connections? What are the mechanisms that grow neural connections? And connectivism looks into that. And there, you know, for me, learning theory, quote unquote, is the description of what creates or modifies or adjusts neural connections or connections in general. So association is a strong connectivist, or, you know, a strong learning theory in the sense of getting people to associate one thing with another. But the other thing is just the pure mechanics of it. Connections in the brain don't just sort of spontaneously go poof, right? you have to grow them and develop them. And the analogy that is used, and many people have used this, is that it's like a muscle. And you have to exercise it. and you have to exercise it in the right way. And, you know, it's practice and reflection, and that's what you do. And the role of the teacher on this theory is model and demonstrate. So you have the person at the front of the room saying, you know, and the student goes, and the student develops their muscles, right? And the thing is, and what's important here is that there isn't, you know, a cognitive piece of knowledge that is passing from the teacher to the student, right? That whole story is a fiction.
Correct. I'm glad you say it, sir. Thank you, Stephen.
And you know, a lot of what I've had to say about connectivism over the years has been to argue against that theory. Now, what's really interesting these days is that we've seen this sudden surge of interest in artificial intelligence. For the longest time, artificial intelligence was based on the idea that there really is knowledge or information being passed from one thing to the next thing. That's called good old artificial intelligence, GoFi. Good old-fashioned artificial intelligence, GoFi.
That is an awesome term. I'm going to have to remember that one. Thank you.
And it's kind of like a cognitive psychological theory of computation. It's basically what they call the physical symbol system of hypothesis. Knowledge is the manipulation of symbols and the communication of symbols. If you ever studied Moore, Moore's theories of educational communication. Forget his first name. There's too many Moors in our business. But anyhow, it's totally an information theoretical account of knowledge and learning. By contrast, the recent success in artificial intelligence is based on, are you ready for it? Drum roll, neural networks. What are neural networks?
Connections. I think I may have read something about this on Newsweek. I think what you say is now starting to go from, research-informed, you know, into praxis, as it were, right? Taking what is kind of, you know, bubbling up.
I hate the word praxis, because praxis, the nutshell definition, is theory-informed practice. But from my perspective, the theory comes long after the practice and is kind of a rationalization of what you were doing all along.
That's a lot to think about right there.
People don't like that position of mine, because so much effort, especially in education, is invested in theory, right? And you haven't really advanced education unless you've theorized something. But I think to theorize something is to get exactly wrong what it is that we're trying to do. But that's all on the side. So, yeah, neural networks are collections of connected entities that acquire knowledge by learning. With learning theories, there are different learning theories. If you study neural networks, if you study even older machine learning models, you learn a whole bunch of learning theories, a whole bunch of different organizations of neural connectivity, different algorithms that manage the weights between individual digital neurons, activation values, simulating the activation of a neuron. I'm not saying that artificial intelligence is the same as human intelligence. What I am saying is that underlying both of those is a set of principles of neural of connectivity, of knowledge created as a form of connectivity. There is a whole mathematics of it. We see it in other domains, in social domains, for example. And that is basically connectivism. Connectivism is recognizing this underlying, I don't want to say theory because that's not right. This underlying network structure beneath neural
network. Can we call that an epistemology or an ontology?
It's more of an epistemology. The ontology would be, you know,
The just theory of being. Yeah, I just wanted the opportunity to kind of step into that.
That's more of an epistemology, but that even those traditional divisions of philosophy kind of break down a little bit here, you know, because it's on the one hand it's pure mathematics, on the other hand it's very practical practice in the classroom to get people to develop their muscles, and it's also a theory of social networking. Which is what takes us back to the Federverse. If we want to develop a collective intelligence as a society, then we don't want a broadcast model of information transfer from one thing to another, which is what we get with the algorithm and advertisements and silos like Twitter and Facebook. We want a distributed network where people communicating with each other can influence each other on a direct person-to-person basis. And that pattern of connectivity is what constitutes social knowledge as created and exemplified by the Federverse. So as you ask if I'm still doing connectivism,
thanks for the update on connectivism.
Sort of like asking, are you still doing mathematics?
Well, that's right. Or it's astronomy, is that still sort of a thing? But honestly,
I like that. Yeah.
It's I really every time I sort of participate in any of your events, whether it's at a conference presentation or checking out OL Daily or your significant other resources, because again, folks, for those who are just sort of new to the notions of machine learning or distributed learning or, some of the, avenues into the field that Stephen was just describing, fortunately, very fortunately for all of us, Stephen keeps a wide variety of resources, links, and outputs going back decades, actually, more than 20 years, that's decades plural, of, just some of it's ephemera, some of it's really substantive, heavy, stuff, in terms of the philosophical writing, which may be kind of, challenging for people who don't exercise those particular muscles. I wish that we had 2 hours to speak, sir, because I would enjoy that immensely. You've given me up to 1 hour of your time, and I want to be respectful of that. I guess what I would just say is thank you for everything you've described thus far. It's been super interesting to get an insight into, what you're about currently, what you has sort of led you to where you are. Was there anything that we didn't cover? Is there anything that you find particularly, like you mentioned Mastodon as being a worthy kind of project right now that's out there. Are there any other kind of feel-good stories within the e-learning sphere to kind of take us out on this one, sir?
Like one subject that's long interested me is open access and open educational resources. We haven't talked about that a whole lot. I consider them to be an essential part of this whole network-based approach.
Awesome.
And we've, over the time I've been working, we've transitioned from a world where just everything is presumed to be closed and you have to pay for it, to where the bulk of the work that's happening in academia is happening in open access journals and in open databases. I think that's a huge social accomplishment that 100%. We haven't seen, haven't seen the full benefit of yet. But, when we look back, we'll see that as a turning point.
Do you see, thank you. That's awesome. I wonder when you're talking OER, so we're talking, in terms of the projects undertaken in that space by groups like eCampus Ontario, BC Campus, Campus Alberta, I think that's what they're called in Alberta. I guess every, it's sort of like, there's capacity for that seems to be growing. At the same time, you kind of like with those kind of organizations that I just kind of, describe, those are kind of like the significant ones. Are there any other, you know, exemplary, like for instance, with the H5P project or some of these other, are there any OER applications or, you know, delivery systems that are particularly doing a good job?
Well, I mean, just open technology generally. I mean, generally, most of the work's happening again in the Fediverse. But, you know, like when I set up my learning environments, like I set up a learning environment for a European group, I used things like Discourse for discussion. I used things like PureTube for hosting videos, WordPress, and its unfortunate block editor for a lot of their stuff. Those are important technologies.
Those are your go-to tools, as it were.
Those are my go-to tools. Big Blue Button for video conferencing is
excellent. They're doing very good work. I agree.
Moodle, again, they need a rethink, you know, because
if you're taking into account a necessity to use a learning management closed application in the first place, Moodle's the one that is the least problematic in terms of vendors or a commercial interest, you know, for a wide variety of reasons. And I can't believe I'm winding down this show by saying something awesome about a learning management system. I wouldn't have anticipated that at the beginning of this conversation. I really, again, want to be respectful of your time. Stephen, I am supremely grateful that you've joined us. I'm supremely, you know, I think I can say that on behalf of Dr. Reed, you know, my Doug, the colleague, co-host. You know, your perspective has been valuable, and it's really anybody who's just sort of checking out Stephen or his work for the first time. We are going to be having selected resources available on our corresponding WordPress post in good open educational practice fashion, because we do try and embody what we describe, you know, within our thing. And I guess, Stephen, thanks a lot for being here. Is there anything else before we end the recording?
No, I think that's about it. I mean, anything else I'd say would launch us into another 10 or 15 minute discussion, so we don't want to do that.
I would love to, very much, but again, it's the middle of the day, and I think I'll just, you know, let you get to what you're doing. Stephen, thank you so much. Thanks, everybody, for listening. I'm going to end the recording now. Take care, everybody. Bye for now.